From KMUW Wichita.
From Toronto, Ontario.
And from Armenia, Spain.
This is You're Saying It Wrong. Let's talk words. Let's talk about the winter. You wouldn't believe how many different ways there are to say it's cold. I'm Fletcher Powell, host and producer at KMUW in Wichita, Kansas, and joining me as they do each week, language experts and New York Times bestselling authors Kathy Petras and Ross Petras. Hey, Kathy. Hey, Ross. It is winter. Technically, it is winter around here. And as I say this, probably we'll have a huge cold snap and everybody will be under ice when they hear this. But at least around here, we've had a lot of days in the 60s this winter so far.
Wow.
Still technically winter. So let's talk about winter. Maybe we can make things feel a little more seasonally appropriate.
And we're going to give you a little quiz. These were unusual winter words chosen by Merriam-Webster. And can you tell us what they mean? If you get two out of this batch, I'll be impressed.
Okay? We did not know them. Let's be honest here. I did know some, but not most of them.
Yeah, we had an argument about one because Kathy was surprised I didn't know it. I knew one or two as well because of the Latin. So whatever, let's go through it. The first word is?
Apricity.
Apricity. Apricity. Kathy sent me these words. I'm not going to look ahead. I'm going to do my best not to look ahead. Anyway, apricity, A-P-R-I-C-I-T-Y. Apricity, the apricity of winter. That is how far you can see because of the snow. The apricity. The apricity is 12%.
You're absolutely right. It's uncanny.
This is going to be fun because I think I'm going to get just destroyed on this quiz. Tell me, what is apricity? That's really interesting.
I like the word, actually, in a way. I like how it sounds, apricity. And, I mean, you can read it on. I mean, you can read it right now. It means basically the warmth of the sun in the winter.
That's very
pretty.
It actually comes from the Latin apricate, apricare, actually, apricatus, which would mean to bask in the sun, which goes backwards from apricus, which is exposed to the sun, and it's the opposite of opacus, which is shady or obviously opaque. And they think it comes from to open, aperire, which means to open up.
I'm just thinking about how you would use it. Would you talk about the sun's apricity, or is that implied? Do you just talk about apricity? Like, would you say the pale yellow glow of the sun and its calm apricity, or would you, like, how would you use it? And use it tastefully. Make it sound pretty.
I frantically looked this up, so I'm cheating. On the rare occasion, the sun will shine through a cloud with apricity during the winter season. Here's another older one. Whilst the apricity touched both of their faces, the kisses on Mike's neck told her that he was most happy and ready.
Yeah, great. So you don't need to reference sun in order to say apricity. Like, it's implied.
It's implied.
Oh, that's cool. Okay. That last one was nice. Nice enough.
But I've never used apricity.
No, but if you wanted to be poetic.
Is apricot related to apricity? Is apricot come from the same root, the Latin, like something to do with sun and exposure? I'm curious.
Why did you ask me that, Kathy? I don't know.
I'm sorry.
But I just found out.
As Mr. Latin, you and his
The origins of apricot, but I should have faked it because I quickly looked it up as Kathy was speaking. And it basically, they think it comes from Catalan, near your, I should have asked you instead, near your area, because it comes from Albercoque, which is related to the Portuguese Albricoque. And it, here we go again, come back from the Arabic Albercoque, which I should have known, although it's mishmish in modern Arabic, so I'm okay, I'm safe. But then it comes backwards to Ross being bad because it comes from the Byzantine Greek Bericocchia, which comes from, I hate to say it, Kathy Latin. Malum precocum, early ripening fruit.
Yeah, Catalan. Yeah.
So you got me, Kath. I missed it. It comes from the Latin after all.
All righty. Of course.
Doesn't everything?
I wasn't debating it.
I think that's kind of a nice word. I kind of like that one.
I like it too. I like it a lot.
I'm not sure about this next one.
Okay. This is the one that I knew because of Latins, just to give you a clue.
The word is hyamel.
Hyamel. I don't like how that sounds, and I don't like I don't like how I thought it was going to be pronounced either. It's H-I-E-M-A-L. I thought it was going to be hemel, and I don't like that either. So this word, just get it out of here. Hyamel, hyamel. Something is hyamel. It is, this makes me think of like a barren snow-covered landscape, a hyamel set of hills. Yes, that's what it is. It's a barren snow-covered landscape where nothing can grow.
You made it very poetic.
I'm trying here.
Basically, it comes from the Latin word hyams, which is winter. So it means wintry, of relating to winter.
Oh, okay. Wow.
So
that's a kind of boring one.
Yeah. Well, yeah. I guess I just wonder, like, where would you use this now? Is this just one of those words that exists that just floats out there and nobody uses
it? Let's say you're reading the Daily Miner News.
Okay.
The Daily Miner and News, and you're in Manitoba.
Mm-hmm.
And you're talking to a winter ecologist. Here's a sentence that it was just used in from 2022.
Oh, wow.
January. We have reached what W.O. Pruitt Jr., a winter ecologist from the University of Manitoba, dubbed the hyamel threshold. So it's a winter threshold of something or
it's
other.
It's a fancy way of not saying wintry, really. All it is a way to...
I think you should say the winter threshold. I don't see why you need this.
Sure. Well, it sounds like maybe it's used in a scientific way.
Yeah, but why can't they say winter?
Look, I don't know that, but just like lawyers, scientists sometimes use words that just work in their circles, even though we have much simpler terms for them.
Yeah.
Okay, I just learned that the winter solstice is also known as the hyrnal solstice.
The hyamel solstice.
And the hibernal solstice. But when I look up hyamel online, basically it comes up an article saying, let's talk about winter words,
that makes a lot of sense.
Yeah,
that makes a lot of sense, because I don't think it's useful at all.
Yeah,
I knew it from a kid, because I mean, Latin, Caesar's always doing winter quarters here and there as he's slaughtering people, so the word was like always around, so it was easy. But hibernal is actually sort of interesting too. It's easier to pronounce, it sounds nicer. But it comes from the same origin. It actually comes from hyams, which is winter, so whatever.
Mm-hmm.
But moving right along, we have another word. Okay, subnivian.
Subnivian. Subnivian. S-U-B-N-I-V-E-A-N is how this is spelled. Subnivian just makes me think that it's under the snow.
Correct.
Correct. Very good.
Nice. I got one.
Very good. How did you know under the snow? How did you know that? That's interesting.
Honestly, it was a huge stretch, but I know that in French, snow is neige, and that
very good.
Just that Nivian made me think of snow, and obviously sub is under.
Very good.
And in
Fletcher.
Spanish, it's nieves, which is even easier.
Oh wow, that would have been really easy. Yeah, that would have been much easier. I guess I got there either way, but okay.
In Latin, it has an X ending, but then when it's conjugated, I mean, when it's declined in terms of different forms, the V comes in. So, yeah.
What is it in Latin?
N-I-X.
N-I-X, that snow.
Yes.
Oh, wow.
Snow and...
Nix.
But what happens is when you're... I think we've talked about this, and not to be boring, but when you, like, the word goes into different parts, it becomes, like, the V comes in. So it'd be nix nivis, the V, or which would be pronounced the W.
Yeah.
Comes in then. So I don't think we need to go on and on about this. I'm Oamasabat, all that again. But.
Next word, psychrophilic.
Psychrophilic.
This sounds like a...
It looks like psychophilic, except there's an R in
there. It does. So I know.
P-S-Y-C-H-R-O-P-H-I-L-I-C. I just don't know what psychro is. I mean, philic means you love it, right? Yeah, I mean,
yes,
yeah,
that's good.
Psych. I mean, okay. So, are we looking at three parts of a word or two parts of a word? Is psychro different from psych? is the I don't know what the row means. Okay, so look, I just really love winter. You know, it's my favorite season. That's all this means. I just really love winter.
Okay, that's pretty good.
Yeah, it's actually not bad.
A psychro mean it comes from the Greek psychro meaning cold. But they also, I just looked at something, there's a psychrometer, or a psychrometer, I guess you'd say, which is a cold measuring device. You can say you're a psychometric technician, which means you study cold and humid air. And there is a cave in Crete called the Sikro Cove, which is a cave, which is a cold cave.
Cold
so there we go.
Cave.
The problem is, though, is you still think psycho.
Yeah.
I completely agree.
I can't handle the R in there. It's like psychrophilic is you're insane about something. I'm done.
Or you like psycho people or something. I do not like this word. I don't like it.
This is probably why we don't use it, really, right? Because it's too close.
Well, if really got to be a scientist, because really what it is organisms that grow and flourish in close to freezing temperatures.
Yeah.
So it's like it's like things that grow well when it's less than 20 degrees centigrade.
Yeah.
Yep.
Okay.
So there's absolutely no reason for any of the three of us to have ever discussed psychrophilics unless, you know, you're growing things in a cold place.
Although one minor point though, sort of interesting, because the word, it's just I like how words kind of change meaning or go kind of weird around, because the original Greek word was psychrein, which means to blow or to make cold, and they think it might psyche, the, you know, like the psyche of a person might be related to it, which is sort of cool. I think blowing in the wind, your animus or whatever, and making it cold too.
Oh wow, yeah.
That's interesting, because I've just always thought of psyche in the myth, but I never thought of it as having, you know, a meaning beyond like the fact that she was there.
Yeah.
Well, now we're going to move on to a non-Greek, non-Latin word.
That's something that we all love.
You don't say. Yeah.
Okay, Fletcher, guess where this word came from.
One of the Nordic countries.
The word is skijoring. Skijoring.
And that's how it's pronounced? Skijoring?
Yes. Skijoring. Emphasis on the first syllable.
I would bet it be skijoring. Give the Northern European.
We're doing the Ross, the Americanized pronunciation.
Kath, when I go skioring in...
in the fjords.
In the fjords, yes, exactly.
S-K-I-J-O-R-I-N-G is how this is spelled. Skijoring. Skijoring. Well, we know what ski is, sort of. I mean, like, we know what to ski is. This is more like cross-country skiing, though. This isn't like downhill skiing. This is cross-country skiing, skijoring.
No.
Okay.
But skiing is involved.
Okay.
It's derived from the Norwegian word skijoring, as Ross said, which has the O with the line through it.
Oh, right. Yeah.
And it means ski driving. And it's you're on skis. It's kind of like water skiing, but you've got a you're on snow skis and you've got a horse or a dog or some other animal or even a motor vehicle pulling you.
Wow.
And you go through an obstacle course. It sounds
weird.
Insane.
This is a thing people do.
Yeah.
That makes sense. I've just never heard of it or seen it before. Is this popular?
Apparently it was in the Olympics in 1928.
Huh. How about that?
But it doesn't seem to be that big. Some people are saying it's cruel to the animal. I don't know. But they have Skior Canada. Yeah, they do. They do have it. I didn't know about this at all, but they do have skioring in Canada. What is skioring in News USA? Everything you need to know. It originated in Norway.
U.S. Mountain West, too.
Yeah.
The Rocky Mountains, they do it, too.
And they do it right here in Ontario. Skioring trails in Ontario. Here they're saying skijowering. I don't know how to pronouncing it. Who knows? Whatever. I think we've learned something. And when I talk to some people, I'm going to find out how they pronounce it. But Kath's right. They say skijoring here, skijowering, skioring. I don't know.
It's something that I would never, ever do. So I don't really care how it's pronounced, frankly. I mean, truth be told, I don't think I would ever be pulled.
Did you put the next word in, Kathy? Sitzmark?
Yeah, it's there.
Okay, I didn't know what this was, and I used to go skiing a lot. Kath knew it, and she didn't go skiing a lot. So let's see if Fletcher knows it.
Okay, the word is...
I know Kansas is a center of skiing,
I mean,
we'll see if you...
That's part of the problem here. Sitzmark, Sitzmark. You've already sort of tipped me off that it has something to do with skiing. So thank you for that.
Mm-hmm.
A Sitzmark. It's a part of the ski course that you shouldn't go past because things are very dangerous if you go past there. That's, it's a Sitzmark.
I think, though, Ross, there's a good reason why I knew this word.
I think you're right, Kathy.
Is when a skier falls backwards, their butt leaves a mark in the snow.
Sitzmark.
Swear to God. Yeah. That's a Sitzmark.
Oh, wow. And, of course, there's a word for it, isn't there?
I know. I like the word, actually. The German is seat. Sits is seat, to sit down.
Uh-huh.
So it's sitting down, a mark made by sitting down is what it is. Yeah.
Yeah. I love it.
Do we do brumation?
No.
Okay, so brumation.
Brumation. What is a brumation? What is brumation? Brumation. B-R-U-M-A-T-I-O-N. Brumation. We're talking about the winter here. This is a huge snowbank that is impossible to go past, a brumation. I could not get to work because of the brumation outside of my house.
I like that, actually.
It's a state or condition of sluggishness, inactivity, or torpor exhibited by reptiles during winter or extended periods of low temperature. I suffer from brumation personally many times.
It's a weird word because it comes from the Latin bruma, meaning winter. Again, another Latin word, or winter solstice. But the weird thing about brumation is apparently scientifically they distinguish hibernation and brumation.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
Cold-blooded animals brumate, mammals hibernate. I guess because they can, like, you know, eat a little bit or drink a little bit, wake up a little bit or something, I guess.
Yeah, because you're just being sluggish. You're not, like, out of it totally. You're just, you know, being like a blob. I personally like this concept of brumation. I think that we as humans should embrace it.
We should definitely. And going back to what I said a few moments ago, I couldn't get to work because of brumation. It turns out it was because of my own lethargy. But
torpor, yes, exactly. There actually was this thing just recently, I'm not sure you guys have read it, though, that said possibly very early humans did, in effect, hibernate or brumate.
Oh.
They kind of go and they kind of chill in a cave for a couple months.
Mm-hmm.
I like that. I could do it.
Oh, wow. I'm sorry. I just want to read quickly a thing here. Amateur herpetology circles and zookeepers tend to obsess over using the term brumation instead of hibernation for reptiles and amphibians do in temperate climes. In fact, the internet is infested with those correcting others when they see as an error of terminology. Brumation was a word coined in 1965 by Wilbur Bill Waldo Mayhew of the University of California. And now they're saying they may not brumate, they may hibernate. This is interesting.
Yeah, because he said he did it because he'd wrote a paper about the horned lizard, or horned lizard, as you might say. And he thought that there should be a term that distinguished between cold and warm-blooded animals. That was his idea.
Yeah.
Hmm.
So who's to say? Mm-hmm. I mean, do we want to be Mayhewists, or do we want to be...
This is a big controversy.
It is.
Yeah.
Kathy, you're an herpetology expert. Why don't you weigh in on the brumation, hibernation
debate?
I
actually align with Mayhew and his thoughts on the horned lizard. Yeah. Sorry, what?
Kind of reading the whole thing, I actually think I don't think brumation is a good word. Reading that, I think Mayhew is wrong. I mean, personally, because, like, hibernating animals, from the article I just read, hibernating animals apparently kind of wake up occasionally, too.
Well, they do. They go out for snacks. Didn't you know that as a kid? That was the whole thing.
Yeah.
I'd go out and get a snack and then go back to sleep.
Yeah, I'm not a Mayhewist. I think hibernation is the answer.
I just like the word, so I'm with Wilbur. Wilbur and May, like that, baby.
Oh, wow.
Okay, we're going to end with closing out the winter. Speaking of hibernation, Ross, the word...
Primaveral.
No, it's primaveral.
Primaveral. I'm sorry. I was doing a Latin pronunciation.
Primaveral. I think primaveral works just fine too, because this is obviously related to a pasta dish that we all love.
And... yes, you're right.
Spaghetti bolognese. So right. Yes. God.
Can you tell? Primaveral. Let's say if it's not related to pasta, it is still sort of related to pasta, because this is related to the onset of spring. Spring is coming.
You got it.
Yes.
It's interesting because I wasn't looking at the word, and I immediately put the N in, because it's in Latin, Vernus is spring, and it's vernal.
Oh, okay.
Vernal. And it was interesting that the N dropped out in English, which I didn't realize.
Yeah, that is interesting. But
no,
it's like
a primavera.
Yeah, isn't primavera with like spring vegetables and stuff?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Not one of my favorite pasta dishes, actually.
Nah.
I don't like it either.
It's not that interesting. It's not that interesting. I just wanted to make it sound better than it was.
Well, it's really great after you've been brumating for so long. Yeah. You know?
Look, I absolutely
no hibernating.
This
is a brumation free zone in this group here.
Brumation free zone. Brumation forever. Not forever. Only until spring, and then I'm gonna eat pasta. I got two, just like you said
you
got.
You did pretty
right?
well. Yeah. No, you did pretty well.
Actually,
Fletcher.
That's good.
Subnivian and primaveral.
I only got sits.
Primaveral, that's so
I figured out that
no,
was so
I like it too
because of falling on my butt all the time when I skied. And I'm using the word skiing very loosely. There was very little upright activity. Yeah,
mostly sits marking.
Yes.
Okay, Fletcher, now we're going to go into something really sort of interesting. This is from Chris in Philadelphia. A question for you guys. If undo means the opposite of do, what does unthaw mean? I keep hearing people talking about unthawing something.
What?
And it makes me stop every time.
Unthaw?
Unthaw is very, and we have some letter from AP. A fuel station operator apparently caused the 5:30 a.m. blast by using an open flame to unthaw a frozen tank.
Oh, weird. I mean, it obviously just means thaw, but...
Right.
I don't think I've heard that before. That's very strange.
Okay, you have a ball of yarn. What do?
You unravel it, but you could also ravel it, right?
Right. Yep. So what's going on there?
It's just an emphasizer, I guess.
Mm-hmm.
Do you know the rules of un?
The rules of un. The rules of un. I didn't know this. No, I don't. I didn't actually know this was a rule. I assumed it was just sort of a mistake people made that eventually got picked up and absorbed into the language. Let me just back up real quick. Ravel and unravel are the same thing. We usually say that something,
mm-hmm.
we usually say we unravel something. That's usually what we're saying now. But we could also say ravel, because that also means sort of take apart, just like unravel is.
Ravel the sleeve of care.
I've never heard that in my life. I don't know what that means.
Shakespeare.
Oh, well, that's probably why. Okay.
I just have to say, The Rules of Un is a great title for like,
I like
a,
it too.
A fantasy
I know.
Trilogy,
I like it a lot.
Isn't it?
It's funny because when I said that, I thought, that's a great title. I had the same thing, Kathy.
Think about it. Some sort of linguistic fantasy.
I know.
Mystery.
I think it'd be a great book, actually, A linguistic mystery is good.
The thing is with un, we usually think not. You see un, you think not. Because
mm-hmm.
that's like one of the first things we learn about with the prefix un, is it means not. And in fact, it's one of the first prefixes we're usually taught, because the whole concept of it meaning something, negating something else, is really easy. So yes, un, rule number one, when it's the prefix to an adjective, un almost, not all the time, but almost always means not. You have unripe fruit, unbroken dish, unwashed car, unsmiling Kathy.
Now, Fletcher, for the unsmiling Kathy, can you tell her and us what happens when un is prefixed to a verb? Almost always.
Oh, well, almost always it means you did the opposite thing.
Perfect. Mm-hmm. Except...
except you can't unring a bell.
No, you can't. But we instinctively understand it. Like there's a song titled Unbreak My Heart.
Yeah. Yeah.
And I mean, that's incorrect. Watch out here, people. Okay. But it's incorrect, but we instinctively understand it.
Yeah.
Well, you say, I wish I could unsee that. You go, I want eye bleach. I want to unsee that. And you know, unsee isn't a word, but.
Yeah. Fletcher, you're right, though. Sometimes it can be a intensifier. It's very rare, but it can be used also as an intensifier. The two ones that really stick nowadays are unthaw and unravel. And there's one other one, unloosen.
Unloosen. Oh, okay.
Yes.
Yeah, okay. Unloosen your shoelaces. Huh.
I don't really ever hear unloosen, to be honest with you. I know it's technically a thing, but I don't think I've ever used the term unloosen.
A great evil has been unloosed upon the world.
Okay, yeah.
Yeah, really? That's good. Maybe? That's a good one. Yeah.
Unpeel.
Unpeel is there too. You're right.
Interesting. Unpeel. Oh, I'm sure I say that. Do you want me to peel the banana? Do you want me to unpeel the banana? I'll bet I say both of them. I'll bet I do.
I bet you do.
I think I do. Yeah.
Okay, no one here is a nautical type. I mean, Kathy, of course, is in terms of etymology. Yeah. She loves nautical words. So Kathy, I'm sure will know. I know. She's always throwing in foxholes to everything. And I think, have you ever sailed at all? No, neither have I, but I can. But I don't talk about
Randy was in the Navy.
Okay.
I married nautically.
I know. Kathy always throws in, do you ever know about this nautical word? But I'm sure Kathy can answer this one too.
I love them, gunnels and stuff.
I know.
Yeah.
I know. But anyway, unrigged is another one.
Mm. Oh, okay.
I think Kathy can probably go on to the rigging of a ship and the unrigging, but whatever.
You know, like the spank sail and the mizzen and
yes.
stuff.
But apparently that's another one. But this is a very, very rare prefix to use in that intensifier way. But it goes back to what we had talked about a long time ago. We were talking about inflammable, where in this case, had the intensifier meaning as well.
Mm-hmm.
I was just looking, okay, now, in the case of thaw, unthaw, they're saying, has been used since the 1600s. Hmm. And un was added as an emphasizer. They had the words that, this is the OED, boundless, helpless, remorseless, and witless were added un, unboundless, unhelpful, unremorseless, and unwitless to intensify their meaning.
But I looked at that too. They've really gone all out.
Unhelpless is odd too.
They've all gone. I looked at that as well, and they're really all dead words.
Yeah,
now.
I don't know any. Yeah, they just seem so odd to me. Any of them. You know?
And also I don't feel it. Like unthaw, I instantly think is thawing. Unravel, I think I picture a ball of yarn being unraveled. Those ones I thought were really weird. I didn't see what they're saying.
Like unremorseless, I don't even understand. It doesn't.
Yeah. No, I have to kind of like think it out. Like, what exactly does that mean? And take it apart. I don't think of those as real words anymore.
Chris from Philadelphia. I hope we have unraveled the mystery about thawing for you.
Yeah. Oh, and we have this quick pop quiz for you, Fletcher. When did these cold-related terms enter the English language? And the first one was sort of interesting. Ice cube, 1920s, 1890s, or the 1600s?
Ice cube, 1920s, ice cube. Okay, 1890s. It certainly wasn't the 1600s.
Okay, this is interesting. Well, we have, first of all, the answer is the 1920s.
Okay, so I was right.
No, it's not.
Oh, no, so it's not. I'm sorry. Wait a minute. I was looking at the other. When is it?
It's the 1890s.
It's the 1890s.
Well, you took out.
I did. Yeah. I took it out. I'm sorry, Fletcher. It is the 1890s. Right. But we found one from the 1867, and I want to read about this ice cube for you.
I disagree with this.
I love it though. Find that this is from 1867, June arithmetic lower seventh form for exam papers. Find the side of a square which contains an acre and of an ice cube which weighs 1 million tons. A cubic foot of ice weighing 60 pounds? So we have the biggest ice cube I think I've ever seen.
I mean, technically,
give me see now that
yes,
but... is that?
Oh, that's cheating, Kathy. Of course, I know that. Kathy can read the true 1897 first citation now.
Cut the butter into inch squares. Line the jar with crushed ice and fill with butter and ice cubes. Now that's an ice cube.
That's an ice cube. But I like the giant. I'm just picturing a million ton ice cube. I love that image, actually. Can you imagine the drink it has to go into?
Can I?
Take me a while. Black ice.
Ooh, black
ice. Okay. 1910s, 1820s, 1920s.
Wow.
Black ice.
Huh.
Do you guys get black ice in Wichita?
Maybe I don't know what black ice is. I thought I knew what black ice was, but maybe I don't.
It's thin, hard ice, which is transparent and often difficult to see.
Yeah.
And like on a street, and like on a black street. It
on
just
the highway.
Like
yeah.
Okay. Okay. That's why I thought it was a strange question. Yeah, of course we do. I mean, like, we have roads and ice, so.
You do?
Some people don't believe
but
that.
Do
you'd
you
be surprised.
Ski joring or whatever?
Well, I always associate this with driving. So 1820s seems weird, but I'll go ahead and say that. Maybe like people were skidding around on with their horses and carriages or something. 1820s.
Yeah.
Okay, great.
You're doing
you
well.
Were supposed to think the 1900s,
of
one
course.
Of the 19s.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah. Now, 1827 was the first citation of it published in the OED. Thin, hard ice, which is a transparent and often difficult to see.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It was in some... book, they said black ice was discovered between banks of snow and blah, blah,
yeah,
blah, blah.
That's what I was just about to say. Yeah, it's that. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Because we usually think about it on top of like asphalt or something.
It's asphalt.
Right?
That's what I always think of it as, too. Yeah. Exactly. Okay, the idiom break the ice comes from the 1800s, the 1550s, or the 1710s.
Break the ice. 1550s.
Fletcher, you're getting them all correct.
Yeah, that feels
yes.
like, that feels like some kind of nice literary flourish or something.
Well, actually, the 15, here we have also the 1590s, too. Uh-huh. But the Reverend Father chanced to be one of the first that break the ice and showed the inconvenience that followed. They're talking about the divorce of Henry VIII from the Catherine of Aragon.
Oh,
and that apparently comes from 1553, but it could go all the way up to 1577. But we don't know, but that's pretty close. So I you got it.
It's funny because I would have initially thought that break the ice would have been not metaphorical at that point. It would have been like literally breaking the ice. But then why wouldn't it be?
Why wouldn't they take a metaphor? Yeah, I mean, they were, and in a weird way, they were always breaking ice in those days. You know, we don't really have to break
true.
The ice of a river or a lake, you know, whatever.
Well, I always guess when you read old books and they talk about, like, you know, the wash basin, and you'd break the ice in the morning to, like, get the water to wash your face. It's
I
like,
know.
Oh, good God.
I know.
Like,
which reminds me of a relative who shall remain nameless, who's from the Northwest. She came out here to the East Coast, and we were talking about the dangers of lakes, which I'm sure you all know, walking on broken, you know, on ice.
I love this.
So I said, you know, how dangerous it was. And one time a friend of mine actually fell in when I was a kid scouting. And she goes, I don't see the problem. All you do is you just break the ice until it's harder than you hop out.
Wait, what?
She said, I don't see why. What's the danger? She goes, you fall in. And then when you just break out the soft ice until it gets hard, and then you just hop out again.
What?
And I said, what? It's not quite that. She goes, no, I know what I'm talking about. And I said, have you ever been on a frozen lake? She goes, yeah, I walked across one once when I was in New York for skating or something. Someone went skating and I walked on that. It was hard. And if it broke, you would just fall in, then you just hop out again. I don't see why everyone's all upset about this.
Oh.
Uh-huh. And I said, okay.
Wow.
I know. But the key there is she never broke the ice to know what it's like.
Yes. Wow. You're Saying It Wrong is part of the NPR network and is produced in the studios of KMUW in Wichita, Kansas, by me, Fletcher Powell. Kathy Petras records from her home in Armilla, Spain. Ross Petras from his home in Toronto, Ontario, in Canada. Torin Anderson composed our theme music. Our digital team is Beth Golay and Carly Cooper. Carly Cooper is also our video editor. You can subscribe to our channel on YouTube. You can find all of our past episodes by subscribing to the You're Saying It Wrong podcast, wherever you get your podcasts, or by visiting us at kmuw.org. If you have a question for Kathy and Ross, if you'd like to suggest a topic, or you just want to reach out, you can email me at powell@kmuw.org. or email them at kandrpetras@gmail.com. You can also record a voice memo of yourself asking your question. You might get your voice heard on air. Or you can download the KMUW app and press the Talk to Us button. You can find Kathy and Ross's books pretty much anywhere you get books, and a handful of them are also available on audiobook, read by the authors themselves. Thanks for joining us. We'll be back next week.
Sources and Methods, the crown jewels of the intelligence community. Shorthand for how do we know what's real? Who told us? If you have those answers, you're on the inside, and NPR wants to bring you there. From the Pentagon to the State Department to spy agencies, listen to understand what's really happening and what it means for you. Sources and Methods, the new national security podcast from NPR.